I've got my picks now. I just finished. So I'll unveil them actually here while I'm talking to you tonight. Sound good? Historic.
This is great radio. Thinking out loud here. Do people actually listen to these episodes?
A handful do, yeah. About as many as appear on them.
Well, last year it was Jesus, which got me pretty close, you know, but ultimately Jesus forsaken me, however you say it. He let me down.
Yeah.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, Banal of America Audio, with your host, Tim Banal.
No commercials, no subscriptions, no network, no rules. And at the end of the day, my friends, no comparison. And tonight, really, no playbook at all, just chaos, I hope, because our guest is the illustrious crackpot historian, also known as El Gogo. He's the OG AG. I heard a rumor that he was the driver of the Double Dutch bus. That's a really obscure reference for some folks. And, of course, he's the Wrong Reverend Houdini Kundalini of the Church of Unwavering Indifference. Talking about my good friend Adam Gorightly, finally back on the program. You know, LeBron James goes back to Cleveland. Adam Gorightly comes back to BOA Audio. I'm sensing a theme here in the midst.
Hello there. How's my volume?
It seems okay. You got to talk a little bit. Otherwise, I can't tell how it is. But I feel like I'm much louder than you.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. How's that?
There you go. All right. It seems fine to me.
That's good. Okay.
Yeah, we'll rely on the folks. What folks at home don't know is we were trying to figure this all out moments before we went live. So this is much like the introduction there. Compelling radio.
Bunch of the names.
Anyway,
welcome
back, buddy.
But thanks. Yeah, it was my fault. I was supposed to call in a few minutes early, but you know how that goes sometimes. Yeah, thanks for having me on.
These things happen. No problem, dude. It's a beautiful night, and I'm looking forward to talking to you. I really dug the book a lot. I didn't mention it here in the beginning. I kind of alluded to it, though, as I called you the Wrong Reverend Houdini Kundalini. Of course, the new book is Historia Discordia, The Origins of the Discordian Society, and it's fantastic, man. As I said on Facebook when we were setting this up, I really, really enjoyed it quite a bit. I think it's fantastic.
Great, man. Glad to hear you dig it.
Well, tell people how it all came together, because I, as I said to you, it's a really interesting sort of mix of like all kinds of interesting, I don't know how you describe them, I guess paper artifacts in a way, you know, letters, postcards, stickers, things like that are all like, you know, copied, I guess you could say, in the book, and it's really amazing. It reminded me a lot of the Bill Cooper book, but almost like the antithesis of the Bill Cooper book. It was sort of like a fun kids version of the Bill Cooper book, almost. But tell folks how it came together. Describe it a little bit, because, you know, I really want them to know about it.
I'd be glad to, but before we get into that, what's the Double Dutch Bus? I have no idea.
You don't know that old song? I've had it stuck in my head for like 2 days now. What's that?
Maybe I do. Can you hum a few bars? Probably not.
It's like an old funk song. It's like an old funk song. Yeah.
No, doesn't ring a bell. I'll have to look into it. But
you'll love it. You'll love it.
I'll hold you to that.
Yeah.
Historia Discordia, The Origins of the Discordian Society. And all of this kind of came about because of my interest in Kerry Thornley many years ago. The first time I was on your show was, I think it was your first season, and we did a show on the book, The Prankster and the Conspiracy. Mm-hmm. I think that was in the first year. It was either 2003.
No, dude, you were a first season, yeah.
Yeah.
You were 2003? Let me see.
Whatever year, don't you know what?
You don't even know what Double Dutch Bus is. Come on now.
Anyway,
I found it here. So, I'll post it for the folks in the chat. But yeah, you came on back in the first season, and you were talking about the Kerry Thornley book.
Yeah, and so I got interested in him back in the Way back in the 80s, late 80s, when I was doing a lot involved in writing for zines and trading for zines, and I came across the name Kerry Thornley. Apparently, you know, sometimes posting conspiracy-related articles, but I couldn't make a lot of sense of them back then, but something intriguing about him, so I remembered the name. Then in the early 90s, there was a book by Jonathan Venkin, Conspiracies, Cover-Ups, and Crimes, that the first chapter in the book was dedicated to Thornley. That was probably about 91. And his story basically was he had written a book about Oswald 3 years before the Kennedy assassination. He had been indicted by Jim Garrison. Garrison claimed he was one of the Oswald doubles, a CIA agent and all this. And he was also one of the founders of this spoof religion called the Discordian Society. And in the book, the interview from that book, he told Venkin, this was like in the, once again, the early 90s, that he believed he had been an MK Ultra victim and part of a Nazi breeding experiment and all this wild stuff. So I was really fascinated. And Venkin said at that time he was considering writing a biography. And I was really intrigued. I wanted to see that when it came out, man, because the guy was so fascinating. And Venkin never got around to it. And I started collecting material on Thornley. I thought if I ever have enough material, I'll start a book, you know. So around 2000, I was more seriously considering that. And I got an email, not that I've told this many times, but it's worth repeating to know how all this unraveled. I got an email from
like,
a guy named...
It's like canonical. You have to tell it, you know. It's,
yep.
It's part of the big story in a way.
So, yeah, I got an email from this Newport character, and this was at an email address that only a few people knew, some friends and families, but wasn't related to my Go Rightly writings or anything like that. So nobody really would have known how to email me here, especially somebody I didn't know who said his name was Bob Newport, and he was just passing on the news that Greg Hill, the founder of Discordianism, had died in... July of 2000. So it was July of 2000 I got this email. I go, see, I wasn't that aware of Discordianism, but I knew Kerry Thornley was involved in Discordianism. So I asked him, did you know Thornley too? And he emailed back, yeah, I grew up with the guys. I'm a co-founder of Discordianism. I knew both Thornley and Hill very well. So that was curious. I didn't think a lot of it at the time. How do you know to contact me? So we stayed in touch, and it was next year that I met with him and Robert Anton Wilson. Newport was old friends with Wilson, too. And Newport brought along the Discordian Archives, something he called the Discordian Archives. It was just an armload of stuff, and he let me borrow it, and I scanned it and some of that stuff, and I used some of it in that first book, and there was enough there that I thought, man, this could be another book project. And I asked him maybe somewhere down the road could do another book project. And he was always cool with that. Newport was talking at that time that he might put these materials up on a website or something of that nature. So
yeah,
we fast forward to 2009, and I stayed in contact with Newport, and every few years, hey, you still down with me doing the project? He was always cool with it. Then 2009, I contacted him, and he said, yeah, I'm still cool with it. When you're down here, you can pick up everything. So I didn't know what he meant. I thought I'd seen everything. And so, yeah, I got together with him, and it was several boxes of materials, which has led to these book projects, the website, and I asked Newport at that time, again, how did he know to contact me? And he had no memory of how all of that came about.
Yeah.
So there's kind of a mystery there. Maybe there is some rational explanation, but as I got deeper involved in this project and the Thornley book and subsequent books, there's been all kinds of synchronicities like that. So, Newport he got into landscape painting, and that became his passion, so he wasn't going to do the website, so we've launched the website as well, HistoriaDiscordia.com, and there's these different books. And the current one is, Historia Discordia, same name as the website that shares a lot of these rare materials that went into the founding birth of the Discordian Society and how these things, activities, evolved into the Illuminatus Trilogy by Robert Anton Wilson and Robert Shea, who were both heavy into Discordianism and became a big influence on the counterculture.
Yeah. It's amazing. So what were these, when you got these boxes, part of me, my OCD-ness of it, because I've heard the story a bunch of times, and I read it in the book, too, and part of me is just like, describe these boxes. Was it just a mess of stuff, or was it at least well enough put together that you could kind of, like, leaf through it at your leisure, if you will, to try and figure it all out?
Yeah, Greg Hill, I mean, he called them the archives, so they were organized by different subject matter. For instance, all, he had the different editions of the Principia Discordia. They were all in the Principia Discordia file. So everything was broken up like that. There was a Thornley JFK several files that basically led me to this book project, book that will be published in October that gets more into the Garrison investigation. So things were pretty organized for the most part. It was just basically going through everything, and a lot of it had been sitting around kind of in a storage room for a long time, so it had that, you know, it has the smell of oldness and insects getting into it and that type of stuff. But I went through everything, and there was materials, I mean, just maybe old newspapers and stuff that weren't relevant, so I got that and kind of reorganized it, refiled it again to make more sense to me. Then it's actually in two parts. I have part of it here in the my secretive lair in Central California, then call those the Discordian Archives West. And then there's more on the East Coast, Discordian Archives East, because we got a hold of some other materials. So the guy who's the publisher for Fiji Press has some of the materials, as well as what's called the, we're calling the, calling PUD, the Paste-Up Discordia, which are the actual pages that Greg Hill pasted together to make the most famous edition of the Principia Discordia, which is the fourth edition. So those are kind of like a work of art that we hope to publish that as well in a book, so it can be displayed to show how it was put together and some of the background material on how all that came about. And we'd like to eventually put those on display, but that's a big and costly project. You know, it might be something we could do with a Kickstarter or something like that.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. It's you kind of touched on it. That's what I liked a lot about the book. I kind of said at the beginning here. It's like a combination of interesting sort of philosophical ideas and also sort of a look at this what was going on in the sort of the counterculture at the time. This sort of historical glimpse, you know, like a peeped diary of sorts, in a twisted way, and then also sort of this really compelling artwork and stuff, really cool designs and things. So there's so much going on in there.
Yeah, you know, well, part of it, there's a lot of people involved. You'll see the collages. Greg Hill, the kind of mastermind with Thornley of this, was a very great collage maker, and that's the way he put together the fourth edition. I don't know if you've probably never even seen the fourth edition. That's not in that book, but I have a copy I could send you. And that was, you know, the fourth edition is the most famous one that kind of in spirit influenced Illuminatus and all that. But as far as the material and what you have, it shows, some of the early stuff, how it all came about. I don't get too much, some of the material covers how Discordianism came about. It was basically Greg Hill and Kerry Thornley as teenagers hanging out in bowling alleys, and it always said they hung out in bowling alleys because they'd drink coffee and they'd be able to stay up late. But actually, I learned that it was the beer that attracted them. They could buy it as teenagers. And so, yeah, kids have been doing that in bowling alleys for years and years. And they were heavy thinkers, you know, and they'd have conversations about philosophy and politics and whatnot. And they got talking about chaos and disorder in the world. Why was there so much? They got in kind of an argument about it. And, you know, Greg Hill's position was basically, well, there really is no order in the universe. It's basically just a chaotic universe that we overlay this perception that there is some type of order, you know, but there isn't. Right. And they got talking about, well, all these different religions have made up of these deities, you know, that supposedly brought order into the world. What we need is our own religious figure to be the god of chaos. And Greg Hill said there already is one in Greek mythology, which is Eris or Discordia, the Greek goddess of chaos and discord. So that kind of those conversations launched the spoof religion of Discordianism, you know. And they were just in high school then. And it was just them, maybe Bob Newport. That was the Discordian Society, just kind of an in-joke between these dudes. And so Thornley went off and had his adventures. He met Oswald and all that stuff. Then in the mid-60s, they started coming up with all these crazy Discordian religious tracts. They got back into that, and they put together the first edition of the Principia Discordia, or How the West Was Lost. And the legend behind that for many years was that it had been reproduced after hours in Jim Garrison's office, of all people, in around 1965, because Hill and Thornley lived on and off in New Orleans as well, and they had a friend who worked as a typist in Garrison's office. Of course, Garrison later on went to target Thornley as one of the people involved in the grand plot that killed JFK. So that was the legend. Robert Anton Wilson said that in Cosmic Trigger, but it wasn't actually the case. The friend they had in Garrison's office was named Lane Kaplinger, who was friends with Hill and Thornley and also happens to be the sister of Grace Kaplinger, who we now know as Grace Zabrinsky, who played Laura Palmer's mother in Twin Peaks and has appeared in a lot of other stuff.
only you know of her. I've never heard of this.
Yeah, and so it goes on and on. So I've been in contact with Grace. She's a cool person.
I'm sure.
Just to get more background. So I finally asked the question, well, did Lane copy these in Garrison's office to make the first edition in 65? And she said, no, not exactly. She actually did, but she did copy some things that Thornley had written about the Discordian Society more like in 61 or 62. So the legend is kind of correct that some of the stuff they came up with in 61 and 62 probably influenced the that first edition of the Principia Discordia, and maybe some of that stuff ended up in there. So it's kind of a convoluted story, but
go ahead.
Trying to figure all this stuff out. Huh? It's so that first edition, which the legend was, it was pretty much lost. There was only 5 copies made at the time. And so going through the Discordian archives, I found that. I went, holy crap, that's the holy grail of Discordianism. So that's reproduced in this book as well.
Yeah.
As well as a lot of other stuff we can go into.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, well, you he touched on it. First of all, I think I know the answer to this, but it's compelling and interesting. And Red Sun Superman in the chat mentions it here. You actually get into it in the book a bit, but he wants to know: is it true? This is kind of a softball for you because I think it's a because I get to answer this one. Is it true that the Principia Discordia was part of the Kennedy assassination records, and do you know why they were included?
Yes. And yes, let me see how to phrase it. What they were, what they came out of was the House Select Committee on Assassinations, and I'll go into this even more in the book that will come out in October. There were portions of the first edition in those records, along as well as some other Discordian materials. It's funny, there's a few pages that resemble the first edition I have, but it was like somebody took them and retyped them. And so there's portions, you know, so I'm not sure how it all came about. I think it came afterwards, and maybe Kerry Thornley retyped some of the stuff to distribute them to people is my guess. What also came out of the those House Select Committee files, when I started looking through them, and I looked through them when I was writing the prints during the conspiracy. The main witness against Thornley in the Garrison investigation was this lady named Barbara Reed, who was quite a colorful bohemian character in the French Quarter. And she was also a friend of Kerry Thornley's. And as it turns out, she was also a member of the Discordian Society. And you'll see in the book there, Story of Discordia, we reprinted her certificate, her Discordian, they call it, the Legion of Dynamic Discord certificate, showing she was a member of the Discordian Society, and it's signed by none other than the Bull Goose of Limbo, who was Kerry Thornley. And so that's in those JFK files, and at the time I was kind of puzzled. Why did some of this Discordian material end up? What happened? Barbara Reed, like I said, she became this. She claimed that she saw Oswald and Thornley together in New Orleans. And there was a period where that was possible, a one-week window in like 63, where they could have been there. Through my research, I don't believe in it. I think it's even possible that she might have seen Thornley with an Oswald, with the Oswald double. But whatever the case, she was this witness against Thornley. Really, the only there's only two witnesses that signed affidavits, and the other guy was named Reverend Raymond Shears, who was pretty crazy. Later, made threats against President Johnson's life. So you have these two sketchy witnesses. But so how this stuff ended up in the those JFK, in the National Archives is where they're at, in the House Select Committee assassination files, how that stuff ended up there, I believe, was Barbara Reed, this witness, also became one of Garrison's unofficial investigators, and she's working with this guy named Harold Weisberg. And they caught wind of, you know, he was interested in the Discordian Society, and he suspected that they were up to no good, and informed Garrison of that. And so they started, you know, the speculations ran rapid that the Discordian Society was some type of CIA front organization. And this led to what's known in the annals of, can we use blue language on your show here?
Oh, yeah, you can use any kind of language, but let me cut you off because I want, okay. No, you know what, go ahead with what you got, because I'll circle back around to the, is it Principia Discordia?
It's either one. Did I answer, is it Red Superman? Did I answer his question? I'm almost,
I believe so, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So.
I'm sorry.
Oh, no.
I didn't mean to interrupt you there.
I wanted to make sure I heard all the points, yeah.
Yeah, I think we covered all that. All right. Go ahead with the operation. I want you to say the blue language, though. That way I don't get in trouble with the FCC. You got right. Tell us the Operation Mindfuck stuff.
around 67, no, this was 68 when that was a Garrison investigation was going full force, 68 and 69. By this time, Thornley was friends with Robert Anton Wilson. And like I said, Garrison had all these, he had his official investigators, but he also had a group that became known as the Irregulars, just different JFK assassination researchers who ended up in New Orleans and run around coming up with their own evidence. And this one guy, Harold Weisberg, really had it in for Thornley, as did Garrison. So there was another investigator by the name of Alan Chapman who believed that the Bavarian Illuminati was behind the assassination. Garrison was getting fed all kinds of crazy information. This is one of the things. And when Thornley caught wind of this, he thought, well, let's screw with him all the more since he's been screwing with me so much. And they launched Operation Mindfuck and pretended to be, they came up with this Bavarian Illuminati letterhead, and he would sign it from his Discordian persona, Omar Khayyam Ravenhurst, you know, and they'd send letters to Garrison and other people saying, confirming they were indeed the Illuminati, but instead of being involved in the assassination, they're here to illuminate the masses. And Robert Anton Wilson got involved with this. It was basically, you know, this major prank, and they used Operation Mindfuck and this Bavarian Illuminati mythos in a lot of other ways over the years, and there's a number of those letters by Wilson and Thornley and Greg Hill on the Bavarian Illuminati stationery you'll see in this Historia Discordia book chronicling that period. And a lot of that...
Go ahead.
A lot of that craziness led to a lot of the stuff you see in the Illuminatus trilogy.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's I lost my train of thought there. Well, let's circle back here to the Principia Discordia, because you said in, you were talking about how I haven't seen the fourth edition, that's the most famous, but I thought it was cool that you say in the book, the print the first edition, it says it's the first time in print in over 50 years, so that's pretty cool thing to be able to put together in a lot of ways. But talk about, I guess, what happened here. It evolved into different sort of, they had other editions and they got more elaborate?
It totally changed the direction. When Thornley and Hill launched the Discordian Society, if you look through that first edition, you can see how they kind of set up this crazy organization. And if you were going to become a pope in the Discordian Society, you had to be ordained by Greg Hill, who was Malaclips the Younger, or Kerry Thornley, Omar Raven, Omar Khayyam Ravenhurst. So that was 65, and around 69, Greg said, screw this organization. Anybody, man or woman, who wants to declare themselves a pope should be able to do so. And he totally changed the direction of the Principia Discordia at that point, too, and made it more of a collaborative art project, in a sense. And they developed these things called Groovy Packs, where Greg Hill would come up with some funny Discordian items and whatever, throw it in a letter, maybe throw in a roach in there or something off the wall, and come up with a list of name of different Discordians, and they'd pass this around to maybe a dozen people. And that, when he'd get it back, there'd be cool stuff, you know. And so a lot of these materials, he'd cut and paste them into subsequent editions of the Principia Discordia, which, you know, it became this collaborative effort, this funky kind of psychedelic era, humorous, but also there's aphorisms and stuff in there that just kind of a cool little book. And I have a copy I can send you if you've never seen the fourth edition. And so that is the most famous one. And then in like 70, they printed 500 copies of that. And that got out into counterculture at that time. You could might see it in the head shops. What the hell is this, you know?
Yeah.
And And so, but still, 500 copies ain't that much. Then when the Illuminatus trilogy came out in 76, or 75, excuse me, it had references to the Principia Discordia, just little small references, you know, and it also quoted Malaclips the Younger and took quotes from Omar Ravenhurst's The Honest Book of Truth. And when I first read the Illuminatus, I didn't know any of this background, so I'd see all this stuff, and I thought, it's just a bunch of weird made-up stuff that went right over your head pretty much. But all this was actually based on real materials, the Principia Discordia, and I also came across the Complete Honest Book of the Truth, which we print in Historia Discordia, and I forgot where I was going.
We were just talking about the Principia Discordia and how it's changed over the years. Well, while you were saying all that, though, it kind of made me think in a way. I guess beyond whatever meager amount they got for the printing of all the books, it's interesting that this whole thing seems like it was just, I don't want to say for fun, but it wasn't for profit, let's say, right? They weren't ever trying to, like, make a buck off of this thing. It was all for the sheer enjoyment of being a part of it, right?
Oh, totally, yeah. It had nothing to do with making money.
That's cool, because that's, like, different from any other religion.
Yeah. And, you could buy it. It was, he'd sell them for a dollar or trade something back then. And when I was going through the archives, I actually found a couple letters he never got around the opening where there was a couple bucks for a copy of the Principia Discordia in envelopes he had never opened. But So 1970, 500 copies, really underground. It's mentioned in the Illuminatus trilogy, and people were going, what's this Principia Discordia? Is that actually something? And the guy who was the publisher at Loom Panics got a hold of Greg Hill and approached him about publishing the thing, and that's when it really got some large distribution, like in the late 70s through Loom Panics. Then even later, Stephen Jackson Games, you know, the game maker dude, he came out with a edition of the Principia Discordia with some added materials he threw in there. So, you know, it's evolved over the years. I have one of the Loom Panics copies I can send you. And so it's been a great, you know, a huge influence, but it's not always obvious what the influence or who. Nobody really knows who Greg Hill was, and so in a way it's kind of a hidden influence, but it's definitely been an influence on popular culture.
Yeah, it's kind of like the Double Dutch Bus reference earlier. It's like if you know what it is, you laugh and you enjoy it. If you don't, then you're like, oh, what the hell is this guy talking about? So this game guy who has a game company, he can just print his own version of the book?
Well, that's the deal. The fourth edition, Greg Hill produced it to be a term he came up with called copyleft, all rights reversed. Anybody could republish it and copy it. So that's why other people have republished it over the years. He kind of came up with some novel concepts or a thing called Creative Commons now that puts stuff in the public domain like that. And that was kind of Greg Hill's idea for the Principia Discordia, that he wanted, you know, people to get out there, to get it out there and people could see it. So it was basically a copyleft thing. And there's been subsequent editions, you know, after the Loom Panics. Some have been pretty decent. Others have been crap.
Yeah.
And,
I guess that makes sense.
So, yeah, if you're ordering a copy of the Principia Discordia, you got to make sure of what you're getting, because you could get something funky that they just took all the great graphics and everything out of the book, and you'll just get text, which doesn't make any sense unless you have all the other cool things, all the different collages and stuff that Greg Hill included in the fourth edition.
Now, when you talked about Operation Mindfuck, you in the Bavarian Illuminati, did it, I think you kind of alluded to this in the book, but maybe you could talk more about it. It seemed like they, these guys bombarding all these places with stuff allegedly from the Bavarian Illuminati kind of sparked it as a meme in a way, like in this sort of zeitgeist, if you will, sort of gave it fuel beyond just that one guy who was talking about it?
Well, they definitely helped move it along. I mean, there was probably a few people talking about it, but it was a weird deal. You either had, like, Christian ministers or the John Birch Society were talking a bit about the Illuminati, so Hill and Thornley, they really did some deep research into the backgrounds of the Illuminati, and a lot of that comes out in the Illuminatus trilogy. But according to Wilson and Cosmic Trigger, once they started kind of launching Operation Mindfuck and putting out this Bavarian Illuminati meme out there, it pushed a magic button, and all of a sudden seemed to get things rolling. And legends of the Illuminati started appearing all over the place. So they think Wilson felt he had a hand in creating that myth. And one of the ways they did it was part of Operation Mindfuck occurred in the pages of Playboy, because Wilson was one of the editors for the Playboy Forum during this period, which was basically a column that dealt with civil liberties and that type of stuff. And he was getting all these letters, people talking about abuses of civil liberties, this and that, and he would answer them. But then he was getting a bunch of far-out conspiracy stuff, too, that was just too wild for Playboy to deal with. And that's how he and Bob Shea, they started talking about this stuff. That kind of led to the Illuminatus trilogy. But on one occasion, to put this meme more into popular culture, Wilson, in cahoots with Thornley to a certain degree, as well as Bob Shea, planted this letter in the Playboy Forum asking, they heard rumor from this old man, mysterious old guy that told somebody that all the major political assassinations were done by this, obscure group called the Bavarian Illuminati. Talked a bit about that in the history. And then Wilson, he answered the letter. And so it was in the pages of Playboy. And that helped kind of, set the meme forward, too, into culture. As time progressed, people even suspected Wilson, Robert Anton Wilson, being a head of the Illuminati. And Wilson never discouraged that. He would neither confirm nor deny, because he knew it probably helped sales of the Illuminatus. In fact, he helped encourage those rumors. I asked him, and this is a story I repeat quite a bit one time, I was talking to him on the phone. I have a recording of this somewhere. I asked, is it true you're the head of the Illuminati? And he said, no, I'm the toe. And I said, well, whatever the case, and you appoint me a high priest of the Bavarian Illuminati? And he said, you are here appointed. So not only am I a bunch of other stuff, I'm a high priest in the Illuminati.
I'm going to have to, I'm literally putting this right now into your bio here. High priest of the Bavarian Illuminati, right?
I guess you can roll either way, yeah.
All right, yeah, yeah.
Illuminati, Bavarian Illuminati.
Yeah, well, you already have quite the lengthy intro, but I will add it in.
I know.
I will definitely add it in. Now, did they ever, I thought this was interesting, you reprint a ton of these Operation Mindfuck letters. Did they, talk a little bit more about who these people were that they were sending these things to. Did they ever get any responses from these folks? I guess, I was thinking about this. I didn't get a chance to look back at it. I don't think they ever included, like, phone numbers. So everything was done via the mail, right?
Yeah. Not sure. You see what you see there. They occasionally, I think, got some responses. But, yeah, it was just to tweak the different people they sent these letters to and see what kind of reaction. Another thing, deal they got involved with was called the Jake, J-A-K-E. And this was another deal where they'd say on a certain date, let's bombard whoever this person is with letters in their Discordian letter writing circle. So the date would come, and none of this was really mean-spirited, you know. A lot of it might be somebody who's working in a newspaper columnist or somebody they were digging, and they're trying to promote Principia Discordia or the Illuminatus trilogy. So on that appointed day, whoever this person was would open up their mailbox, and you know, there'd be 23 letters there from all these crazy people coming from different parts of the country that were part of this group called the Discordian Societies.
Well, just to sort of hone in on a point here, all this stuff was generally, I mean, I'm sure they talked on the phone sometimes, but I'm trying to like take people back to the time where it's amazing. You know, they're waiting for stuff to come in the mail to each other and plan things and stuff like that. It's kind of, and as you said earlier, passing these packets around, and it's people don't go to the mailbox waiting for cool stuff anymore. Mm-hmm. So it's a different era. So
I see what you're asking. Did they also talk to each other on the phone and get together? And yeah, they did. But you know, some of them were in different parts of the country. For instance, Wilson and Robert Shea, when he was working at Playboy, you know, they were in Chicago. Later, Wilson moved out to the West Coast, and at that time, Greg Hill was out there, and Camden Daenerys, and some of these other people. And I don't get into it in Historia Discordia, but there was one period, maybe I print some of the stuff, but there was one period where Greg Hill, Kerry Thornley, Robert Anton Wilson, Bob Newport, the guy I mentioned before, Camden Benares, they're all basically within a 5 to 10 mile radius of each other along the Russian River there in California. A stone's throw from Bohemian Grove, of all places. And the founder of Discordianism ran a movie theater there called the Cine Maria. And so they were all... So they had a network. They'd get together occasionally, and they'd party, you know. So, but it, you know, it was more kind of random. Some of the interactions between these folks, and some Discordians on the other side of the country, they maybe never met face to face. Maybe talked on the phone. Some of the people that were in the Discordian Society in other parts of the country, maybe they didn't really know their who they really were, and they were doing work on behalf of the Discordian Society, but it had nothing to do with what anybody else was doing. And Greg Hill always promoted the theme that we Discordians must stick apart, so there was an autonomy to the actions of what all the Discordians were doing. No one really knew at any one time what some of the activities the other ones might be involved with.
Hmm. Yeah, it's really it's really crazy. I don't even know. It's really one of a kind. That's what I really like about this whole thing. It's confusing. It's really creative in a lot of ways. It's amazingly creative. And but as I said earlier, these guys are just having fun in a lot of ways. So it's pretty wild. Well, let me see. Go ahead.
Oh, I was like going to say, if you haven't been exposed to this stuff, I think a lot of people will pick it up and will go, this is pretty cool, but it's kind of, might be a bit confusing. You know, it'd be helpful to, I saw somebody post this, to read The Prankster and the Conspiracy before getting into this material, or perhaps be aware of the Illuminatus trilogy, because it's kind of a lot of crazy oddball cool stuff if you don't have it in context. And you know, we've done that with the Historia Discordia website too, to put more background and things that weren't going to make it in the book just because of space limitations. So there's a lot of material at the website, I think, equally as cool as the book, that we'll continue posting stuff up there because I just, you know, there's a wealth of material here, and I see the website, you know, continuing to add fresh content for quite a while.
Now, are any of these folks who were part of the whole scene? I know most of the principal players have passed away, but are there any sort of peripheral characters who are still, you know, up and kicking and talking about this at all? I imagine some have grown up and moved on with their lives and don't really deal in it anymore, or what, you know.
Yeah. Well,
so what's the status of the remaining original Discordians? Is probably the best way to put it.
Bob Newport, the guy who turned me on to stuff, and he has, he's also a contributor to the Principia Discordia. He's still around. I mean, they did a lot of this stuff years and years ago, so I sent him a copy of the book, and he was pleased, and he was like, oh, God, this brings back some memory. You know, I know a heck of a lot more of it now than they do because it was so long ago,
yeah.
You know. But it still has a fond place in their heart. There's Louise Lacey. I mean, she was involved in it, and I got her a copy of the book as well. She's she's contributed stuff, letters to the archives, so they're still around and very colorful people, have led fascinating lives. There's some other probably less more minor characters, but there's old Discordians still around. The major players, yes, have all passed on. Greg Hill, Kerry Thornley, Camden Benares, Robert Anton Wilson, Robert Shea. They've all shed the mortal coil.
Is Kerry Thornley still alive? I don't know. You might have just said him or not. My brain flashed out. Is he still alive or not?
No, he died in 98.
Oh, okay. Because in the book it didn't list that he died, so unless I missed that one, I was reading it, so maybe I did. What was I going to ask you there?
In fact, in the book, in the last couple of pages, I post the obituaries for both Hill and
Thornley. Oh, okay. I think I didn't get that far. I got tied up with something, so I didn't really, I missed that. 1,000 apologies, sir.
You had better things to do, okay.
No, I feel like I'm walking all over you. I feel like I'm stepping on you here. So I apologize. I feel like I'm cutting in too much, but I'll try and ride the horse better. But so all these folks are gone. Did it kind of fizzle out? Like, because you know they're mailing this stuff around the country to each other. They're having a good time. Clearly, at some point, the party ended or something. Like, so how did it sort of fizzle out?
Well, Greg Hill, he was a pretty genius guy, but he also had a he's more of an introverted character. Thornley was this crazy extrovert, but these guys were friends. But Greg Hill had a side to his personality where he'd go into deep depressions and all this. So I was talking about that period when they were out there at on the Russian River, and they were doing all this cool stuff out there. They started this movie theater that got all the locals involved, so it was basically a community project. They started kind of a community center. They'd have music on the weekends where they'd feed the homeless, so they were involved in all that kind of stuff too, but and the Discordium stuff was going on. But sometime around 73, during that period, Greg Hill's wife left him. He went into a major funk, and that whole scene fell apart there, and he moved to New York to become like a bank clerk of all things. And so things kind of fizzled. He tried to get it going again with some doing stuff by the mill, but he's affected by alcoholism, you know, and these type of things. So kind of went into a a bit of a funk there for a period of years. Oddly enough, he ended up, came back to the West Coast around 77 or so. And I think that's when he started working for Bank of America, of all people. And he wrote the initial computer programming software for Bank of America.
Yeah.
Everything, you know, kind of led to ATMs and all of this stuff. So he was also a techie nerd guy, and also came up with what I believe was the first computer solitaire game. And so
yeah.
he had a big hand of people screwing off at work, you know, for many years. So
forever.
Goddess Eris would be pleased. But yeah, so the right as Illuminatus was kind of taking off, I think Greg helped promote it during that period, you know, and got kind of active again. But, you know, as you got into the late 70s or 80s, it kind of fizzled out. Greg Hill saved all his letters. So there's communications with different Discordians into the early to mid-80s. People who had found out about him and his address, and they would send, you know, they'd wanted to get Pope cards and a copy of the Principia Discordia, so they would mail him. So a little bit of that was going on, but by the mid-80s, I think he had lost the interest in it, and it had kind of fizzled out. But that didn't stop Discordianism from continuing to evolve. And, you know, if you look on the internet now, that you can find all kinds of Discordian groups and different Discordians around the world. I've been working with a guy who also contributes to our Historia Discordia website named Brenton Clutterbuck. That's his real name, and he's an Australian lad, and he's been traveling the world interviewing Discordians for this book he's writing called Chasing Eris. And so for some strange reason, this movement has continued to grow throughout the years, which doesn't mean if you're a Discordian that you like any of the other Discordians or vice versa. There's no the interpretation of what Discordianism is and what each individual Discordian, how they identify themselves, is can change all across the board. So it's kind of this loose-knit, autonomous religion.
Yeah. It's kind of like an in-joke. If you know what's going on, then you're hip to it. If you don't, you're like,
yeah,
what, you know. It's kind of like thumbing your nose at the squares.
Mm-hmm.
Hillbilly wants to know, this is a good question, actually. I have an answer or a response to it, too, but I'm interested in your take on it. With the Alphabet Agency's ability to monitor everyone's every move, communication, thought, does Adam think that it might put a damper on such endeavors as Discordia? I guess he means in modern times. Yeah, presumably.
Oh, well, maybe it has. now, well, this as far as addressing that, people involved in Discordianism these days, maybe that is happening. You know, on Facebook, you have different groups. And I think, you know, obviously there's a certain amount of meddling that goes on with people joining Facebook groups and trying to undermine them, and perhaps with political groups or whatever. So obviously that goes on.
Trolls.
Well, you got to, yeah, it's totally with any Discordian group, you have all that craziness going on there. So it's become, if you're interested in Discordianism, and you go to a internet forum or Facebook page, within a couple minutes, you might become quickly discouraged and think these are all a bunch of juvenile jack-offs, and a lot of them are. So maybe there's meddling that goes on that way. As far as alphabet soups or whatever trying to undermine the Discordian Society. I don't know, maybe that's happened. Thornley, you know, Garrison, they were suspecting that the Discordian Society was a CIA front, which all the Discordians found hilarious at the time. Then in the mid-70s, Thornley got a bit paranoid and started thinking, well, maybe Garrison was on the right track about a lot of this stuff, and this was a bad period for Thornley. He started suspecting that a lot of his friends were in on some type of conspiracy. He suspected for a while that Robert Anton Wilson was like a CIA mind control handler or something of him. And,
oh, God.
Yeah. So
Jesus.
Thornley went through a pretty heavy period there. And Wilson had been a defender during the Garrison investigation of Kerry Thornley. He was one of the few people who stood by him because it was trendy then to jump on. Garrison was popular with the left side of the political spectrum. And a lot of the magazines and stuff Wilson was writing for was on the more liberal side of the thing. So he was one of the few that supported Thornley because people who bought into what Garrison was saying saw Thornley as some right-wing CIA type of guy. So, Wilson defended Thornley earlier than, in later years it was like, now Thornley's suspecting that Wilson was his mind control handler and thought Wilson showed up in Atlanta in the mid-70s with Timothy Leary, and I have these letters, and it's pretty evident that Thornley went through a period of when he was of having paranoid delusions, and this is experiencing schizophrenia to a certain degree, and this has been confirmed with a lot of people, including Robert Newport, their good friend who's a psychiatrist for many years. Thornley, it was really a period of 2 or 3 years when he really went into a deep funk, and I think he came out of that, and appears, at least from some sources, that he got on meds, and you look at interviews, I posted other interviews with him, he looks like ones we posted recently from the early 90s, he looks perfectly sane, rational, and very fascinating, interesting fella.
Yeah.
So I don't think I answered, hopefully I answered Hillbilly's question.
I think you did. I have a response in a way. Maybe you can jump on that if you want. It seems he's asking sort of if the government surveillance would dissuade endeavors such as Discordia. I think if anything, it should encourage the whole idea in a sense. Discordia, the whole idea is to cause chaos. There should be more people creating these crazy religions. Keep these alphabet agencies on their toes and confused all the time. Where it's like, we need more the tactics of the Discordians.
So he's maybe thinking or asking, would people less likely to do this type of stuff because they think they'd become more visible to the government?
Yeah.
And yeah. Perhaps. Go ahead.
Oh, that was good. Yeah, well, I was going to say, just to cause trouble. Just to cause trouble, they would do. Oh, I would be afraid to mail a letter though like that nowadays. I feel like I feel like you're probably violating some kind of law just to mail a prank letter to someone. I'd be scared.
Well, you know what? Yeah, certain things happened after 9/11.
Yeah.
And so they all had these crazy Discordian names. Wilson was he used a lot of different handles like Mordecai the Fowl and Malaclips the Younger, and there was one of them was named Fang the Unwashed. Omar Khayyam, Ravenhurst, they all had their Discordian handles. Nowadays, if you send a letter to somebody, and, you know, before 9/11, you could send a letter to Mal Eclipse the Younger, and it would get to Greg Hill just because it was at that P.O. box. I ran into this just the other day. I sent somebody a copy, and I used their conspiracy name, and it got sent back, and he went to the post office, and yeah, that's kind of what one of the things that's come down, you know, in this these latter days. If you're using an alias of that nature, that would bring you to the attention of the powers that be, you know, just because of all the terrorist fears that are going around these days.
Yeah, yeah, they just don't want anyone having any fun. But I'd be scared to mail. Right. Mail a crazy letter, you know, because someone would be like, what you doing? Call the FBI on me because they sent them a letter from a fucking, you know, Dingleberry the Third. It's like, thanks,
yeah,
dude.
Sending to different organs. A lot of them were so tongue-in-cheek and so crazy. It's like, they, yeah, I could see where, yeah, they'd call in the authorities. It reminds me of, what's his name? Mosley and Great Barker, when they came up with the straight letter that they sent to George Adamski, Barker was, he was probably the greatest Discordian in the history of ufology because he was playing these type of pranks all the time. All kinds of stuff from prank phone calls. I've looked into Barker quite a bit, too, and he was, I think, it's pretty evident now that some of the creepy phone calls that John Keel was getting during the Mothman thing was Great Barker talking
what?
Through some talking through some mechanical device. And,
how do you come to that conclusion?
I'll send you one article I've written. One of the sources was Alan Greenfield in an interview I did with him, and Barker made a bunch of, that was typical Barker stuff. He made prank phone calls to different people in the UFO scene. He made, and he put out these publications. One of his claims, he came up with the whole doppelganger thing in different books, like the, I forget the title. He did a Men in Black book. They knew too much about flying saucers, whatever. He started these legends where he was seeing Jim Mosley, doppelgangers, and other doppelgangers, and he was making all this stuff up to sell books and put the mythos out there. For instance, he was a early member of Albert Bender's UFO group. Bender was the guy who claimed that this was like in the early 50s, that the three men in black showed up and silenced him.
Yeah.
And that they were government agents or something. Reading different books and Mosley's account, the reason he was, Bender claimed he was forced out of ufology because of this, but it was basically just a way that to get out of ufology, but... So Barker, you know, he was part of Bender's organization, and he printed Bender's book, and he came out, Barker did, with his own book on the whole Bender affair and the Men in Black. When Bender first shared the story, the Men in Black were just presented to government agents, but when Barker got a hold of it, and I believe it was in They Knew Too Much About Flying Saucers or whatever the title was, the Men in Black had changed now, and he attributed, an air of mystery, that they talked in strange patterns, they had a strange skin pallor, they showed up in these vintage mint cars that were like 20 years old, and that they were possibly, the hints he gave that they were maybe some type of alien hybrids or whatever. And so Barker was involved in all these type of type of scams. Mosley writes about it in his book, and one of the things, yeah, was writing these letters, and they wrote out the number because, yeah, this is straight out of Discordianism. As the legend goes, one of Barker's saucer pals, some young man, had a father who worked in the State Department, and this kid got a hold of a bunch of State Department stationery and sent it to Barker. Every couple times a year, Mosley would go, and they'd get together in West Virginia, and they'd start drinking and make phone calls, or this one time was like, oh, look at this stationery. What could we do with this? And, of course, that's when they composed the straight letter to Adamski. He got a hold of it and basically said, the State Department thanks you for your efforts, Mr. Adamski, and we do confirm that you have seen UFOs, but we can't publicly say it and all this stuff. And Adamski got it. It was like he was parading the thing all over the place. And the feds got wind of this, and, you know, they questioned him about it. Where did this came from? I think the FBI, they questioned both Mosley and Barker, but they were never able to pin it on him totally. Barker got shook up, and he busted up the typewriter, and he buried it and cemented a construction site there in West Virginia. And so Barker had his hands in all kinds of stuff, and at least that's
interesting. He may have played a hand in the whole Mothman mythos. That's amazing.
Oh yeah, totally. And he was there, right? He was involved in all this early stuff with the. He lived in West Virginia, so the whole Flatwoods Monster story. He was one of the first "quote unquote" reporters on scene, so he reported that. He went and he wrote a book called "The Silver Bridge," which is his account of the whole Mothman thing, because he was there at the same time John Keel and some other people showed up in Point Pleasant. So Barker put his own spin on it, too, and he usually added a lot of colorful embellishments, to say the least, to his stories. And so, yeah, a lot of people credit him with really the having a big hand in the creation of the mythos of the Men in Black.
Mm. Did he know Keel, or was he like, or did they?
Yeah.
How much did he even know him?
They were friends. They knew each other.
Oh God! And do you think Keel knew that he was pranking him, or do you think they had both had a right laugh about it afterwards, and it was just into the mythos, or do you think he never really knew?
I think, Keel wasn't in on it, but as he knew more, found out more about some of the shenanigans Barker and Mosley were involved in, he wasn't too fond of them, especially Mosley later years. He called Jim Mosley a boil on the ass of ufology.
They
knew each other. They were friends, and they did conventions together. Mosley was the main one in the 60s and early 70s putting on, you know, the UFO conventions. But I'm sure somewhere along the line, Keel, suspected Barker maybe had a hand in that stuff. But he probably didn't want to admit, though, that he'd been had.
Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense. Well, you're talking about strange characters. I got to ask you to revisit something I'm sure we talked about on the show before, but I need a refresher on it, because every Earth Day comes around, and I try to tell the story of Ira Einhorn, and I always, you know, feel like I leave out the details and just say, he murdered his wife or something, so you should look it up to people, so... Tell the story of Ira Einhorn and how you guys crossed paths later on in the you know, later on in time. But, you know, tell this story in general, because it's absolutely amazing, and I want to be able to recreate it someday to impress people myself. So let's hear about it.
Yeah, my homeboy. So Ira Einhorn was involved in the 60s counterculture, kind of, you know, involved in anti-war stuff and the yippies. He lived in Philadelphia, so there's a book about him called The Unicorn Secret. If people want to find out more, they can read it. He knew those people, the Abby Hoffmans and the Jerry Rubens, ran in those circles. And in 1970, he was they had the first Earth Day, so he was one of the founders, the people who launched Earth Day. That was 1970, and they had it, I guess, different parts of the country, so he kind of organized the Philadelphia Earth Day. He was also involved in a lot of paranormal shit. He was involved with Andrea Puharik and Uri Geller during a period in the early 70s when they made contacts supposedly with extraterrestrials. Puharik, the famous parapsychologist dude, he had a farm or ranch or whatever he calls it out in Ossining, New York. Is that how you say that? And he was carrying on different experiments and stuff there with Uri Geller, and Ira Einhorn was also part of that scene, and he witnessed a UFO or two upon occasion. Apparently they were having, where they were out at Puharik's farm, there's a lot of weird stuff going on, so it's like supposedly like one of those places that attracted strange energies and stuff.
What's that place? That ranch out there in Nevada.
Yeah,
Skinwalker Ranch. Yeah. So he's mixed up in all this paranormal stuff.
And that's pretty interesting there too, because he had an influence. I was just reading yesterday, doing some research on UFOs and whatnot, and there's a book that came out on Uri Geller and Andrea Puharik called UFOs, and I forget what the title was, but it talks about this whole period. And in the introduction, Puharik thanks his friend Ira Einhorn, who made this project possible. And according to Einhorn, I interviewed him later, and he said he also helped edit and publish Messengers of Deception by Jacques Vallée.
Oh, wow, really?
That. So he was involved in that scene, but also in the early 70s, he was into spreading the word about suppressed technologies, Tesla technologies, cutting-edge stuff, and he got funded by Bell Telephone, some of the family who owns it or something. They became patrons of Einhorn to put this material out, and Einhorn put this network together. And I think they used some early forms of telephone, internet stuff, really cutting-edge stuff. So he was involved in all this, and they were, you know, these people were funding, basically, that's how he made a living, doing all this stuff. So he's involved in all this paranormal, Tesla technologies, anti-war dude, whatever, peace and love and all that. Then in the late 70s there, I forget the exact date, the body of his girlfriend was found in a steamer trunk, all hacked up from an axe in his apartment there in Philadelphia. So yeah, he was picked up for that, and there was a trial, and his attorney was none other than Arlen Specter. You know who he is?
Yeah, it says he fled the country, though.
Well, yeah, we're getting
the guy gave him, oh, okay, all right, I'm sorry, the magic bullet theory guy.
Yeah.
Oh, wait, Arlen,
that was his attorney. There's all these odd connections. And so, anyway, Einhorn somehow, he got bail and skipped the country.
Okay.
And he wasn't seen for many years. And if you read this book, The Unicorn Secret, when they published it, and it came out in the mid to late 80s, and at that time Einhorn was still on the lam. And actually, there were stories. People had seen him in Great Britain or Ireland, and he had a different name by then. His appearance had changed quite a bit, and there were some Interpol or somebody was got close to capturing him, but when they showed up to where he was living, he was gone. And so that was in the 80s, and it wasn't till in the 90s that he showed up again. And he was in France, and at that point, his extradition status wasn't clear, so at that point the U.S. couldn't bring him back for a trial. I guess they never finished his first trial. They'd just gone in for whatever preliminary stuff. So he was over there in France for a few years, living at this, the French countryside, this nice house with the he had his wife there, blonde-haired lady, basically rubbing it in the face of the government here that wanted to get him extradited back here to try him for the murder of his girlfriend, Haldy Maddox. And so around that time, 98 or so, I was somebody gave me Ira Einhorn's email address. And so I thought, I'm interested. This is an interesting character. I want to try to set up an interview, and I did interview him for the Excluded Middle magazine.
Yeah, it's in the Excluded Middle anthology. Yeah, it's excellent.
And the one I did was the first interview he did. After that, they came out with a piece in Vanity Fair.
Yeah.
And there was some weirdness going on when I was interviewing him. I felt that I can't give you all the details, but my email was being monitored. I was getting hints. Somebody sent back one of the emails I had sent him from another address that had been kind of truncated and led me to suspect that somebody was monitoring our emails and letting me know. Wasn't doing anything illegal necessary, but and so Einhorn's argument was that somehow the CIA was involved in Haldy Maddox's murder to set him up. He and other people have suggested, well, maybe Einhorn was some type of MKUltra patsy who was mind-controlled since he can't remember exactly what went down. Einhorn was connected with different people who have kind of spooky legends about themselves, like Kit Green, who people said was modeled after, or that the character on X-Files was modeled after. And so there's all that stuff going on. And anyway, he finally did get extradited back to the States. It kind of surprised him. He thought he was safe over there. Later in the 90s or 2000s, and then he was tried and convicted for Haldy Maddox's murder, and he's in prison here in the U.S. Greg Bishop interviewed him on Radio Mysterioso when he was still over in France.
Oh, nice.
And those interviews are still up somewhere, I think, on the Excluded Middle website, but Einhorn always danced around the he'd never answer any of the pertinent questions regarding the case, which is kind of curious. So
and it's like I don't remember any question.
well he's kind of a clever guy too, so he'd turn it around or dance around stuff, and it was pretty obvious when Greg interviewed him. Greg was getting frustrated, and he doesn't really air his frustration. We talked about it later and hear different parts of the interview where Greg kind of picked up the phone and threw it across the room because he was getting so pissed off. Einhorn wouldn't answer any pertinent questions. And he never really did for me either when I interviewed him, you know? So
yeah.
He wanted to take the conversation more into all the wonderful things he was doing to save the Earth.
What could cause that? Clearly aliens can cause that, as happened in Roswell, New Mexico, as happens in a television show I like called The Event. You have to face facts that aliens are all around us, and they have finally gotten to the NHL.
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
Creepy. That's what this is. You pointed out that I spent a lot of time in Dallas, 20 years, working just a few blocks away from the grassy knoll, the book depository.
So you're a conspiracist.
And the conspiracy museum, which, oddly enough, has been closed down now. Conspiracy? Could be. Something odd is going on here.